And he snapped the strap again, saying, "So you've never schooled a nigger?" A shudder passed through Joseph's body. "No, sir," I said. "But Mr. Fish told me all about how he handled that chicken thief up Benito way, and how Maybell shot an old man's eyes out." I stopped then, for something had eased in the floor-shine man's countenance. He even chuckled, saying, "I doubt Vernon Fish ever will love a girl so true as he does that colt of his," which set a few of the men around Joseph to tittering. Then he yanked Joseph's head up by the chin and said, "What do you think, boy? Should I leave your hide to Vernon?" Joseph said nothing. "You answer him, boy," one of the uniformed men shouted. Another hauled back and kicked Joseph in the stomach so hard the air rushed out of his mouth. But Joseph kept his eyes down and did not move. "I sure would appreciate it if you'd let me handle this boy myself," I said, stepping closer to the floor shine man. "I've been struggling lately, bucking rules and acting all kinds of awful. If you were to let me deliver him like I promised, it might prove to my pop and Mr. Fish that I'm on track for real. And well, I'd just be awful grateful, sir." The floor shine man looked from Joseph to me, said, "Who's your pop?" "Stanley Tillman," I replied. And he tipped his head sideways and looked surprised, saying, "The same Stanley Tillman who sold me my Victrola last year." "That's him," I replied. "The one Vernon's been trying to bring into the clan for months, even though he's married to an Osage squaw?" Told him yes. Then I felt the thin ice under my feet starting to crack as the floor shine man came at me. And just when our chests were near close enough to touch, he laughed and slugged my arm so hard my teeth clattered. "Why didn't you say so, half-breed?" he boomed. "Your pop saw the light and joined up tonight. He's one of us now." Pop had filled out his application, paid his fee, and joined the clan right there on the courthouse steps in front of God and Vernon Fish and the floor shine man, whose real name I learned was Reggie Gould. Reggie told me the whole tale with relish, saying how Pop's view on Negroes being harmless had changed soon as he saw the first armed carload of them drive up to the courthouse, and how Pop said that if they were willing to confront the sheriff with guns, they surely wouldn't hesitate in doing the same to him at his shop. Which sounded close enough to Pop's sort of reasoning for me to believe it was true. But bad as it hurt to hear them tell about Pop's change of heart, some good came of the exchange. For Reggie and his boys let me drive off without harming the Tylers or Joseph, believing as they did that I was about to deliver all three to Vernon Fish. That's how I ended up driving down the outer edges of the city like a madman, desperate to get Joseph and the Tyler safe. Turned out I'd no choice but to stop again, when a second body turned up in the street with a fist-sized hole blown out of its chest. For even after all the trouble we'd run into so far, my instinct was to pick it up and see that it was buried proper. But Joseph peeked up as the truck slowed, and when I pointed to the corpse, he said, "It isn't safe, Will. Keep driving, please." His voice bobbled about, which was understandable given what had nearly been done to him not 5 minutes prior. There was no question it would be risky to stop. So I drove on near a half mile until the next obstacle presented itself. Only that time it wasn't a corpse, but a living man. A living man who I hit with the truck. It happened at the intersection of 5th and Detroit. He'd only intended to step out into the street long enough to flag me down. That much was clear. But he misjudged my speed and distance by a good 10 feet, so there was no way I could avoid him. Fortunately, I only clipped his hip. The man and the shotgun he'd been holding spun through the air separately and landed hard on the ground. Then came an awful silence, followed by the sound of Mrs. Tyler's sobs and a moaning from the street. I told Joseph to stay put and got out. Judging by his grease-stained overalls and the black under his fingernails, the struck man was a roughneck. That didn't account for the red spot blooming on the leg of his pants, though, for even in Tulsa there was no mistaking blood for oil. "Help me," he wheezed. "Please." Then his gaze jerked to something past my shoulder. It was Joseph, standing behind us with his legs set wide, and the roughneck shotgun aimed at its owner's head. "Give me my gun, and Get away from me, you goddamn nigger, Roughneck hissed. Joseph pressed the muzzle to the man's cheek, whispering, How many goddamn niggers have you killed with this gun tonight, sir? I leaned away out of sheer instinct and contemplated telling Joseph not to shoot. But given all we'd seen that night, it didn't seem right, me trying to influence his decision one way or the other. So I rose, silent, and stood at his side. The man's dry throat clicked. Joseph's finger came out of the trigger guard, flexed, and went back in. Might be this is my chance to even up the score a little, Joseph muttered. Though whether to me or the Roughneck I couldn't say. And his hand trembled so bad I feared he might fire, whether he meant to or not. He squeezed his eyes tight, opened them, resighted down the barrel, and spoke so there was no doubt he was talking to me. I've spent my whole life forgiving white folks, Will, he said, and I am so very tired of it. Then he lifted his head from the sight, lowered the shotgun, and carried it back to the truck without another word. Who shot you? I asked the Roughneck once Joseph had got safely in the back. He was silent. I poked my toe into the flesh of his leg near the bullet hole. He gritted his teeth, said, I ain't telling you nothing, boy. It was a poor choice. I pressed the sole of my shoe down square over the bullet hole. He roared in pain and set about expanding my repertoire of curse words until I lifted my foot to stomp him again. At that, he quieted and held up his hand, breathing ragged. And he feigned contriteness, saying how he was bleeding bad and couldn't move because the truck had broke his other leg and wouldn't I please help him? Only if you tell me the truth, I replied. I bet it was white men who shot you, wasn't it? He spit on my shoes and told me to go to hell. Only I went to the truck instead, to fetch twine and the handkerchief Reggie had stuffed in Joseph's mouth. And I caught that Roughneck as he cursed and howled and tried to drag himself away, and I tied his hands tight behind his back and stuffed the handkerchief in his gob. For it was at that moment that I realized how very much I wanted to be a righteous man, just like I told Vernon Fish low those many weeks ago. And a righteous man would never leave another human being to bleed to death in the street. Of course, a truly righteous man would take pains to keep the Roughneck's ruined legs from knocking against the truck bumper as he loaded him in, so I can't say I was quite there yet. But I kept that miserable so-and-so alive, and did him no permanent harm, which, in my book, was at least a step in the right direction. The church was dark and locked up tight when we arrived, and the clouds overhead had cleared enough for the moon to shine on the empty roadway. Still, there were dark shadows and corners aplenty. No one came when I knocked, so I knocked again, and the lock turned and hinges squeaked as the door cracked open. I recognized the oval-faced girl peeking out. Her name was Claire. Like Addie, she was a year ahead of me. Unlike Addie, she wasn't pretty. Not in the standard sense, at least. But there was something pleasing about the way her strong features fit together, especially with the electric light casting a halo's glow around her nest of disheveled brown hair. Yes, she said. My words tumbled out ahead of my thoughts. Please, Mr. Tyler's head's hurt bad, and Mrs. Tyler, she's... Before I could bumble on, Claire lit up with recognition and opened the door wide and called me by name. And there was such a sweetness about her that my tongue tangled and my eyes filled with tears. And I feel no shame in saying that, for it was a moment of true grace. Where are they? She asked. Can they walk? I pointed in the direction of 7th Street and said I didn't think so. Then Claire told me to drive the truck across the grass and park close to the door. Once I'd done as she said, she came out of the church with a man and a sturdy woman in a nurse's cap, both of whom climbed inside the truck before I got the engine shut off. I heard the nurse talking in a worried voice, and Joseph saying something about a rifle butt. Then the man went back inside the church and fetched a makeshift stretcher made from a sheet and 2 mops. Jackrabbit quick, he and Joseph loaded Mr. Tyler onto it and carried him inside. That surprised me, I'll admit, for I'd been raised in a world where white folks' needs always came first. It shocked the Roughneck, too, and he sputtered and coughed around the cloth in his mouth while old Mrs. Tyler watched. Then Claire climbed in and introduced herself, and the roughneck quieted enough for her to take out the handkerchief. And he plastered a false smile across his face and commenced to line, saying how the Negro boy who just carried the old man away had shot him, and how I'd run over him with the truck after that and stepped on his wounded leg to torture him. Claire looked at me as if to ask, was it true? I hung my head and said I'd hit him with the truck all right, but it had been an accident. She didn't inquire about the torture, only told the man there was a doctor inside who could tend to his injuries till morning. Then the church door opened again, and a trim and dapper Negro with rolled-up sleeves stepped out of the church. "He's been shot in the leg, Dr. Butler," Claire said. The doctor climbed into the truck, ignoring the man's curses and slurs. And when he tried to touch the roughneck's leg and the fool commenced to scream in bloody murder, Claire picked up the handkerchief and stuffed it back into his mouth so tight that even his grunts were muffled. It was a relief to everyone, most especially Mrs. Tyler. Her eyes sparked to life, and she asked if I wouldn't please take her inside to her husband. I said it would be my pleasure and helped her out of the truck, bending low so she could get her arm across my shoulders for support. We made our way into the church, down a set of stairs and through a door that swung open when I tapped it with my toe. And it's a good thing I'm built sturdy, elsewise the blur that flew across the room into my chest would have knocked Mrs. Tyler and me down like so many ninepins. The smell of roller skate grease and the feel of small arms squeezing me tight hit all at once, so that my heartbeat skipped about and the shadow over my soul lifted like a thousand sparrows taking flight. Then I reached down with my free arm and lifted Ruby up and hugged her hard. "Ow! Ow! Ow!" she squealed. "You're gonna squeeze my guts out, Will Tillman!" Only I didn't let go, and neither did she.
Rowan. A spark lit up inside Joe when he mentioned the body, bright enough so I could see it through his wrinkles and the morphine and the pain. I forgot all about being in a nursing home, and the cookies, and even James, and asked him who it was. "I'm sorry, young lady, but I can't tell you," Joe said, which felt like the sound a bird makes hitting a window. But short of threatening a dying old man, there wasn't much I could do about it. James asked him, "You can't or you won't?" "Both. I swore to my father at his deathbed that I'd carry his secret to my own grave. And there's no breaking a deathbed oath." Out in the hall, a feeble voice started hollering for Mary to take him home. Joe sighed. "That's my roommate, Herb. Mary died 5 years ago. He forgets. But tell me, what have the two of you learned on your own? I never did promise not to help other folks find the truth for themselves, and maybe I can steer you in the right direction." Which was better than nothing. So James and I traded off telling Joe about the Polk directory and the house title and everything else we'd tracked down. "But how did you find out about my father in the first place?" Joe asked. "From the receipt," James said. "Receipt?" Joe brought the back of his bed up higher. "The Victrola receipt he made out to someone named Jay Goodhope. It was in the skeleton's wallet," I said. "Here." I slipped the receipt out of the envelope in my purse and handed it to Joe. "See?" Joe's fingers trembled as he pulled it close and squinted. "Damn it," he said, fumbling for his reading glasses on the tray. I picked them up for him and held the receipt while he put them on. He mumbled, "Thank you," and took the receipt again, making a sound that was a sob and a laugh all at once. Then he traced each word and figure with his fingertip, whispering, "I can't believe you found it." "You knew about it?" I said. His head nodded on the thin stalk of his neck. "I knew of it. It's just not something I ever thought I'd hold in my own hands. You've made an old man very... very happy." Which wasn't exactly what James and I had set out to do that morning, but it felt good anyway. And when I asked Joe if he knew who Jay Goodhope was, he nodded again and said, "Of course." He's my namesake, Joseph. James and I locked eyes as Joe went back to reading the receipt. Joe? James said. Do you happen to know if Joseph was any relation to Della Goodhope? Joe was still running his fingertips over the paper like he couldn't believe it was there. She was his mother, he said, and Ruby was his sister. James took out his phone and held up the picture of William Tillman for Joe to see. And this was your father, William? Yes, though he went by Daniel after he moved to Kansas City. I've seen this portrait before on the bookshelf at my grandmother's house. Wherever did you find it? In Central High School's 1921 yearbook, I said. He was a junior then. But why did he change his name? Joe smiled. Dad dropped out of school and moved to KC after the riot in 21. He wanted a fresh start. And I suppose changing his name was part of that. He did well for himself, too. Sold Victrolas and wax cylinder dictation machines, then radios and hi-fis. Say, you don't happen to have Joseph's picture, do you? From the yearbook? James asked. You mean he was still in school, too? Joe took a breath to speak, then stopped like he was afraid he was giving too much away. But before long, he got this what-the-hell kind of look and said, That's right. Only he didn't go to Central. Joseph was a senior at Booker T that year. Now we were getting somewhere. If you were named after him, they must have known each other pretty well, I said. They did. Joe folded the receipt back up. Rowan, would you be so kind as to bring me the photograph and the gilt frame over on the windowsill? I picked up the picture he motioned to and saw a younger version of Joe standing next to a wrinkly black woman in sweatpants and a Naughty by Nature t-shirt with the OPP album cover on it. That's Ruby and me back in 2001, Joe said. June 1st, to be exact. I tried to show the picture to James, but he was looking for something on his phone. Are she in that shirt for real? I asked. Every inch of them, Joe laughed. Ruby lived out loud like no one else I've ever known. James was still mumbling to himself. Let me just... Here! He shoved the phone in front of me. The image was of a yellowed page with three photographs in heart-shaped frames. The top and bottom pictures were of girls. In the middle was a serious-looking young black man with chubby cheeks and something written beside him that I had to enlarge the picture to see. A better soul you'll never meet, no matter where you roam. His mind is sharp, his manner sweet, his heart true to his home. Joseph Goodhope. Have you found him? Joe looked so eager that James handed him the phone and let the picture speak for itself. There he is, Joe said softly. Just like Ruby and Dad described him. You mean you've never seen him before? I asked. Joe shook his head slowly. No. Joseph died young. But Ruby lived a good long life. She was 90 years old in that picture, though you'd never have known it to meet her. She worked as a nurse until they made her retire at 75. After that, she kept busy with volunteer work. She died in her sleep just a few weeks after her 97th birthday, only a month after she brought me the last pie. The skin on my forearms prickled. Pie at the Nut and Honey Cafe. Tilda's peach pie at Arvin's funeral. Joe, did you say pie? I asked. His smile was wistful. Indeed I did. Ruby made one for us every year on the 1st of June. In the beginning, she'd take a Midland Valley train up here to Pawhuska and leave them on Granny Catherine's doorstep. But after Granny died, she brought them to me. Joe lowered the picture, closed his eyes, and sighed. Best peach pie in the whole wide world. Mom was in shorts and a tank top sitting cross-legged on the back porch when I got home. Beaded drops of condensation dotted the untouched glass of iced tea beside her. When I came through the gate, she pointed toward the open back house door. "Geneva's here," she said, which wasn't exactly news since I'd already seen the van. Hammering started up. Mom ignored it. I sat beside her and asked what was going on, and Mom told me how Geneva had called her at work, asking to be let into the back house to check on something she'd overlooked. Mom had called me, but I'd turned my phone off after deleting the voicemails about Arvin that morning, so she'd come to let Geneva in herself. "Now," Mom said when she was done explaining, "tell me where you've been all day." There was no point lying. I told her about Pawhuska. "You were supposed to be resting," she said. "But I'd probably have done the same thing if I were you." A man in white painter's coveralls came out of the back house. He laid a floor plank on the grass, saw Mom and me, and gave us an awkward hello before he went back inside. The hammering started up again. Board by board, he carried out the subfloor, lining each piece up carefully. Mom's legs stayed tucked underneath her. I slipped off my sandals and pushed us back and forth in the swing. "They're tearing things apart," I said. "Eat your heart out, Captain Obvious." Mom dipped her finger in the pool of water gathering at the base of her glass. "It seems that way." We kept swinging. The man kept bringing out planks and Mom kept not talking. It got so weird that I ended up asking her if I could visit Arvin's Aunt Tilda the next day, just to kill the silence. "You haven't asked my permission for things like that in a long time," Mom said. "Why start now?" "I don't know," I said. "Maybe it's not so much that I'm asking as that I wanted to tell you." There was only one rectangle left to go before the floor was completely reassembled on the grass. Mom pinched the middle of her shirt and pulled it away from her belly. We were both sweating like crazy. "I like that," she said. "It's nice. But there's something else I want to ask you. You don't have to answer right now. In fact, you should think about it as long as you'd like. At least overnight." There was nothing to do except say that I would. "Good," Mom said. "What I want to know is, if you're sure that Jerry Randall used a racial slur and pushed Arvin out of anger instead of self-defense, would you be willing to go speak to the district attorney with me? Maybe even testify about what you saw and heard in court?" The hammering stopped. The swing stopped. Geneva carried out the last board herself and waved Mom and me over, saying, "I'm glad you're here, Rowan." "Think about it," Mom said. Then she got up, and Geneva told us not to come down off the porch. "You'll have a better view from there," she said, climbing the steps to stand next to us. She leaned over the rail. The man, who Geneva never did introduce, but must have been her gallbladderless assistant, stood off to one side. "Sure enough. See that?" Geneva pointed toward a dark stain that covered the board farthest away from us on the left, and parts of the ones around it. "That's where our skeletonized friend bled out. It's a typical spread pattern for exsanguination due to head trauma. But look." She pointed to a separate stain midway up the opposite side of the reconstructed floor. "That one's from a different victim. Someone who received a significant injury bled out, then dragged themselves a ways. They never made it all the way across the room, though. See how their blood trail stops 2 feet short of the other one and spreads again?" Mom was quiet at my side. "What does it mean?" I asked. Geneva rubbed her palms against her cutoffs and shrugged. "It means I should have checked under the floor sooner. But it also means we know more now than we did before. And in my book, that makes it a good day."
William. The basement was a big space filled with women and children, all of them frightened and weary, but safe as they could be given the circumstances. A few electric bulbs were strung up overhead, and there were lit oil lamps scattered about. Claire drew 2 cups of coffee from a fancy silver urn set up on a wooden bench and handed them to Joseph and me. And that was the best thing I ever have tasted in my life, bar none. Loaded thick with sugar and so hot it scalded my tongue. Then, Claire put her arm around Ruby's shoulder, saying, "Won't you introduce me to your friend?" To which Ruby replied that Joseph was her brother, not her friend. And Claire shook his hand and smiled and told Ruby, "I bet these boys would like to sit down. Would you show them to a cot while I fetch Joseph a shirt that's not cut to ribbons?" Her voice was soft and firm all at once so that Ruby didn't balk. She only said, "Yes, Miss Claire," and led us over to an empty cot like the sweetest, most obedient child he ever did meet. And she sat next to us, chirping on about how she'd set off to find Joseph after I warned her away from the shop. "You sounded for real scared, Will," she said. "Enough so I knew you weren't just trying to get rid of me." Then she scolded Joseph for not being in any of the places she'd gone looking. After that, she turned somber and picked at the back of her hands, telling us how she'd hidden behind a shrub at the courthouse while the white people around her got angrier and angrier. And how a single gunshot had turned the crowd into an ugly mob surging towards Greenwood with murder on its mind. "All except a few of them," she added, "like the man who snatched me up and carried me off." And she looked down at her toes, and for the first time ever, I heard something close to shame creep into her voice. "I scratched him pretty good. Bit him, too. But he didn't put me down till we got away. Even then, he kept hold of my wrist and told me he was taking me somewhere safe, 'cause otherwise I might get killed. He was a good man. That's how I came to be here." "You mean to say you've been in this church most of the night?" Joseph said. Ruby made a face like he was stupid. "Course I have, you big ninny," she said. "Where do you think I was?" Then Joseph cast a grateful look towards heaven and drank what was left of his coffee in one gulp. After that, Claire returned with a white, high-collared clergyman's shirt and said there was fresh-baked cornbread in the kitchen that Ruby should bring down. Joseph and I started to rise as well, but Claire assured us Ruby was up to the task on her own. When Ruby had trotted off with nary a whisper of backtalk, Joseph asked Claire how on earth she'd managed to charm his sister. Claire smiled and sat down on the cot, saying, "Just lucky, I suppose." Then her face darkened. She said how my truck couldn't stay where it was. For according to Mr. Geddison, word had gotten out to white riders that the church was taking in Greenwood refugees. "Mr. Geddison?" I asked. Claire rolled her eyes and pointed at the ceiling, saying, "Your ever-so-pleasant friend. The one with the hole in his leg?" "You mean the roughneck?" I asked. And Claire nodded, saying, "Yes, though it's a shame calling him that. Plenty of oil field hands attend this church, and most of them are kind, decent men. Nothing like that ignorant fool." Then she said how there'd already been rioters sniffing around the church doors, banging and hollering how they'd been sent to gather wayward Negroes and deliver them to the proper authorities. "We ignored them until they gave up and left," she said. "Though, if Mr. Geddison is to be believed, there's another contingent on the way." Which would make having a truck parked outside awfully inconvenient, seeing as how you couldn't very well pretend no one's home, I said with a sigh. Claire smiled and brushed a bit of grass off my shoulder that must have come from Mrs. Tyler. The tenderness caught me off guard. Joseph bumped his knee against mine, said, "I don't relish the thought of you going back out there, Will." "Can't say I do myself," I replied, "but there's nothing for it. I'll just go straight home and hole up for the night. Come morning, I'll be back for you and Ruby." Joseph actually smiled then and stood up and offered his hand and held on even after he'd pulled me to my feet. "Thank you, William," he said. Only his words sounded stiff and formal to my ears. For after all we'd been through that night, the very least we should have been to each other was friends. And so, not knowing how else to show the way I felt, I got the balance sheet for his Victrola out of my pocket and asked Claire if she might have a pen. She found one. And I asked Joseph to turn around and use his back to mark paid across the bottom. "Should have had this all along," I said, handing it to him. "What's left is on us." Joseph accepted the thing without saying it was useless, and took his leather wallet from his back pants pocket and tucked the receipt inside. "Saturday all right for delivery?" I asked. Joseph said he likely could make that work. Then Ruby was back, toting a big basket of cornbread so hot and so fresh that the smell drew a circle of children around her straight away. But when she saw me and Joseph standing, she set that basket down on the floor and stomped over with her arms locked tight across her chest, asking what was going on. "Will needs to take his truck home," Joseph replied. "It's not safe leaving it parked outside. The church has to look empty." "Why?" she pouted. "Can't nobody mess with a church. That'd be a sin." Joseph tried to smile, but what he managed was closer to the mash-eyed look you get staring into the sun. "You're right," I said quick. "But if I don't get Pop's truck home soon, he'll hunt me down and string me up by my thumbs. And I have tender thumbs, Miss Ruby. Very tender thumbs indeed." Ruby giggled, just as I'd hoped she would. "Besides," I added, "I'm coming back first thing tomorrow morning to fetch you and Joseph home. That sound all right?" She stopped giggling and nodded. "Good," I said. "Then go get a good night's sleep, and I'll see you when you wake up." "Promise?" she asked, real quiet. "Promise," I replied. After which Ruby pointed a finger at me, stern as a schoolmarm, and told me to wait. And she waited through the ring of hungry children circling the cornbread, plucked a piece out, marched back, wrapped it in her handkerchief, and took my hand in hers, saying, "You best take this now. Won't be any left by morning." I squeezed her hand and thanked her, and told her she should stick close to her brother. "Phooey," she said. Then she tugged me towards her like she had a secret to share. I dropped to one knee and leaned close, expecting sass or a raspberry or worse. Only what I got was a peck on the cheek, quick and sweet. "Be careful out there, Will Tillman," she whispered as she hugged me. "And don't you forget to come back." Halfway home, on dark streets wearing their silence like a quilt, I remembered the dead man. My hand reached back to confirm that the rolled-up tarp was still there, which it was. No one at the church had noticed, and between the Gettison fool cussing and carrying on and Ruby turning up, Joseph and I had forgotten about it altogether. But there was no forgetting anymore, nor any simple solution to my dilemma. For though dumping the body by the river was the easiest option at hand, the whole reason Joseph and I picked him up was to see that he was treated proper. The least the dead man deserved was a Christian burial and a person or two to mourn his passing, and I knew Mama would understand if I waited until morning to find his people. Things like that mattered to her, which I suppose was why they mattered to me. When I pulled into the empty driveway at home, the kitchen lights burned bright. Mama met me on the porch with her arms wide, and there was so much strength in her embrace that if it hadn't been for the evil I'd witnessed that night, I could have almost convinced myself that things were going to turn out all right. When she was done hugging on me, Mama took half a step back and put her cool palms to my cheeks and kissed my forehead, whispering, "Thank the Lord you're home." In the kitchen, a half-drunk cup of tea sat next to an unfinished game of solitaire on Mama's big butcher block. She poured me a glass of cold buttermilk from the icebox, which I gulped down. And she told me Angelina and her daughter-in-law and her grandbabies were still safe in the back house, but there was no word about her son. "Where's Pop?" I asked. Mama shrugged, lips tight, said, "He called from the shop an hour ago, upset you weren't there when he stopped by to check on things. He should be home by sunrise so long as things stay calm on Main Street." She wanted to elaborate. I could see it in the set of her body, hear it in her guarded words. But she only told me I should go upstairs and wash, which I did. And once my face and neck were scrubbed and I dropped my dusty clothes down the laundry chute, I slipped beneath the clean-smelling softness of my sheets and slept. Even with a dead man in the back of the truck. Even with Joseph and Ruby trapped in a room full of strangers in the basement of a church. Even with Cleet and Vernon Fish and Reggie Gould still loose on the streets. I slept. Sunshine woke me the next morning. I threw on new clothes, washed the grit from my eyes, and wiggled the stiffness out of my jaw from grinding my teeth as I slept. Downstairs, Mama was sitting on the same stool by the butcher block where I'd left her. There was a haze in the room, and an acrid stink that set my eyes to watering. "He took them," she said, all dull and quiet. Which I didn't understand until I saw Angelina through the back window, slumped in the doorway of her quarters. And it felt like a punch to the gut, realizing what the man who'd raised me had done. Pop had taken Angelina's grandbabies away. Mama mumbled something about breakfast and rose from the chair, holding her body sideways. "What's wrong?" I asked. She didn't reply. Then my voice came harsh, asking, "What did he do?" Mama shook her head and said, "He came home half an hour ago and found Angelina's family." Which wasn't what I'd meant. I caught her up in my arms as she tried to get to the icebox and felt my inside seize at the sight of the puffy, reddened flesh around her right cheekbone and eye. Mama stopped my hand as I reached towards the bruise, looking at me with a clarity and resolve I didn't expect. Then she touched my own cheek tenderly and said, "I couldn't keep him from taking them away, but I told him if he put Angelina in that truck, I wouldn't be here when he got back." I started to speak. Mama pressed her fingers to my lips, saying, "Whatever happens between your father and me is mine, William. I'll handle it how I see fit. Right now, there are other matters that need tending to. I want you to tell me what went on last night. Tell me everything." I pulled my hand back and sat down and did as she'd asked. The whole story came out, starting with Joseph besting Pop in negotiations for the Victrola, ending with the body in the back of the truck. Nothing changed or got better while I spoke. Still, once I'd finished, Mama smiled a tired smile and told me I'd done right, and she was proud. "I'll fix you breakfast," she said. "Then you go to the church and fetch your friends and take them to Angelina's quarters at the new house. There are only boards in for the floor, but the walls and roof are sound. I'll call the construction foreman and tell him to send his boys to another job for a few days. Those two children should be safe enough holed up there for a while. I only pray they'll have a home to go back to once this is over." "What do you mean?" I asked. And Mama turned, loaf of bread in one hand, knife in the other. "Can't you smell it?" she said, her voice far away and sad. "They're burning Greenwood to the ground." Mama called the church while I wolfed down my toast and eggs. Turned out the pastor's wife knit caps for babies too, and she and Mama were acquainted through a ladies' luncheon group on top of that. By the time I'd mopped up my yolks and put my plate in the sink, Mama was back with the whole plan arranged. "Joseph and Ruby will wait for you at the same door you used last night," she said. "They're safe for now, but you'll have to be careful. There are gangs of men about town, gathering up Negroes and taking them to McNulty Park and Convention Hall." Her eyes darted to the back window. "I'll have to smuggle Angelina upstairs," she murmured to herself. Then she directed me to fill Pop's and my canteens with water, and loaded our picnic hamper with bread, cheese, and apples, plus a whole Virginia ham she'd bought special for Pop. She put in a carving knife, too, and filled a rucksack with blankets and two pairs of clean skivvies from my dresser drawer. After that, Mama handed the supplies to me through the side door underneath the porte cochere, and I loaded them into the Model T. Lastly, she handed me a drop cloth from the basement. "They'll have to ride on the floorboards, covered up," she said. "Model T's weren't made to conceal much." I said I understood and touched her cheek just below the swelling. She closed her eyes, squeezing them ever so slightly. "Go quickly now," she whispered, "and come home safe." Then I was off, driving too fast and shifting gears as if I'd been doing it all my life. There were no police about, nor any other people at that early hour either. Yet someone must have been watching for me at the church, for Claire opened the side door as soon as I arrived, and Joseph and Ruby scurried under the floor of the Model T's back seat and covered themselves with the drop cloth. Neither said a word, not even Ruby, who looked like she'd just woke up. Claire came out, too, and touched my elbow where it rested on the car. "Be careful," she said. Then she favored me with a brave, weary smile, so beautiful that the memory of it lodged deep inside me. I told her I would, and drove off fast enough that not 5 minutes later I had the Model T backed up as close to the new house's servants' quarters as I could get. Joseph and Ruby hopped out and sprinted to the door, dodging stacks of new lumber and bricks. It wasn't until we were inside, breathing the smell of fresh-cut wood and smoke, that Joseph finally spoke. "They're putting the torch to Greenwood, Will. Shooting anyone who resists and taking whatever they want." I said I'd heard the same, but that there was no telling truth from rumor just then. Then I tried to change the subject, asking if they'd heard anything about their ma. To which Joseph replied that the best they could hope for was that she'd been taken to McNulty Park, or Convention Hall, or possibly the fairgrounds. That's when Ruby chimed in, saying, "Anyone hurts our ma, I'll hunt him down and kill him myself." "Hush now," Joseph said softly. Ruby sniffed and scooted backwards against the wall. "I'll find her for you," I said. "Just promise you'll stay put until me or Mama comes back to give you the all clear." Joseph frowned, said, "Really think we're safe here?" "Safe enough," I replied. "Just stay out of sight and you should be fine." Then I managed to distract Ruby a little, telling her how Mama had put 2 pairs of my skivvies in the rucksack. "I ain't wearing no boys' unmentionables," she said, and stuck out her tongue, which I took as a positive sign. After that, I told them I'd best be going. Joseph thanked me again, and Ruby looked at me square. "You're a good man, Will Tillman," she said. It sounded silly and over-serious coming from her, but wonderful all the same. And those words buoyed my spirits all the way back to the Model T, until the smoke-filled northern sky and the gravity of the task I'd undertaken pulled them right back down again. Cars were parked chock-a-block along the southern edge of Greenwood. White men and women milled about in the smoky haze, carrying baskets and sacks filled with stolen treasures from Negro homes. Clothes, silver, lamps, china, paintings. Looters picked through the smoldering remains of buildings like vultures after a battle. I left the Model T just south of the worst of it and walked north to Jasper Street, where the Good Hope's house should have been. Ash and rubble and a shattered posy dish were all I found. I'd been on a fool's errand from the start, and my heart ached at the prospect of telling Joseph and Ruby that their home was gone. Still, I hadn't given up on finding Mrs. Good Hope, so I headed back south, planning to look for her in the detention centers, until hysterical shrieks stopped me short. It was Eunice, running up the street in a pale green dress too fine and formal to be streetwear, stolen no doubt from some poor Booker T girl who'd never get to wear it to her prom. "They shot him, Will! They shot him!" she wailed. I ran towards her then, and when we met up, she clawed at my arm and dragged me towards a crowd of gawkers standing tight in a circle. "Move!" she screamed, and enough did so we could press through to the center, which is where we found Cleet. At first I only stared, for the sight of the boy I'd grown up with, lying gut-shot and bleeding in the street, was the stuff of dime novels and cowboy movies. Then Cleet's eyes flickered open, and he whispered something so faint that I dropped to my knees and lifted his head onto my lap. "It's all right," I told him. "Just you hang in there while someone fetches a doctor."
"You always were a terrible liar, Will," he whispered.
Then his lips pulled back in pain and his body shivered in my arms, and he spoke again, so soft I had to put my ear to his lips to hear.
"Vernon's gonna kill that brother and sister you got."
He coughed weakly, sending a fine spray of crimson onto his chin. I told him to hush and save his strength, but he shook his head, saying,
"No, listen. While I was home, changing clothes this morning, Mother picked up the telephone and overheard your mama talking to that pastor's wife on the party line. She told me what you were planning to do, and I told Vernon."
A gurgle caught at the back of his throat. He tried to cough, but only succeeded in quickening the flow of blood from his belly.
"Oh, Will, I've done bad things, and now I'm on my way to stand judgment."
The sound in his throat closed down to a rattling gasp. And before I could lie and tell my friend I knew God would forgive him, he was gone. The crowd pressed tighter. I set Cleet's head down, gentle on the street, and shouted for them to get away. Only they didn't. So I screamed at them again and again until they cleared a space for me to push past them. Eunice sat on a curb, weeping. When I asked her who'd shot Cleet, she started crying harder. I lifted her up and shook her by the shoulders till she screamed how she didn't know, that the bullet had come from one of the houses. And I wanted so much to slap her then that it scared me. But I only pushed her backwards, then she cursed me and looked down and caught sight of my bloody handprints on the shoulders of her stolen dress and loosed a demon shriek. I stumbled off, numbed clear through to my soul, until the fact of Cleet dying hit me full on, along with what he'd said about Vernon Fish being out to kill Joseph and Ruby. Then I ceased my walking altogether and ran.
Rowan. I don't believe in psychics or premonitions or fate. Still, something stopped my hand just as I was about to knock on the door. I'd pleaded with James to call in sick again, but he said a third day in a row would get him busted back to clearing tables. I told him he was my Watson and I needed him. He said bullshit, he was my Sherlock, but that I'd be fine. I wasn't so sure. Still, I'd gone ahead and called True to tell him I'd be at work on Monday. Then I asked him how to get in touch with Tilda, because I wanted to see if she'd introduce me to her friend Opal, the one with the peach pie recipe, the one Joe Tillman had said was Ruby Goodhope's daughter. An hour later, I was standing on Opal Johnson's front porch. Now or never, I told myself. Knock. Just knock. Opal Johnson was the jelly bean woman I'd seen using a walker at Arvin's funeral. Inside her house, she left the walker in a corner and steadied herself against furniture. Tilda says you're after my grandma's pie recipe, she said with a dare me and I'll do it gleam in her eye that reminded me of the picture of Ruby Goodhope on Joe's windowsill. She doesn't think I'll give it to you, but wouldn't it just chap her hide if I did? I'd spent most of the night before thinking about whether or not I could convince the DA that Jerry Randall hadn't pushed Arvin in self-defense, and about how doing it would mean putting myself out there for every TV reporter, blogger, and racist comment troll to tear down. When I wasn't obsessing about that, my overactive brain had bounced over to the skeleton and what James and I knew about it. I needed to patch everything together into a story that made sense. The problem was, every time I thought I had, I'd remember some random little detail that didn't fit, and my whole theory would fall apart. By the time I actually made it to Opal Johnson's kitchen table, I was too tired and frustrated to worry about being delicate. Besides, Opal wasn't the delicate type. "It is delicious pie," I told her. "But actually, I came here more about your mother than your grandmother's recipe. See, my friend and I visited a man named Joe Tillman in Pawhuska yesterday." I paused, hoping to catch some glimmer of recognition in Opal's smart brown eyes. No such luck. "Anyway," I went on, "Joe's grandparents built the house my family lives in, and my friend and I went up there to talk with him about what some workmen found underneath the floor of our servants' quarters a few weeks ago." Opal's face was a mask of calm, but her foot jiggled underneath the table. "Do you know what I'm talking about?" I asked. The tapping stopped. "You know who it is, don't you?" She nodded. "We found a receipt from the Victory Victrola shop in the body's pocket," I said. "And the police anthropologist believes the man who died was young and black." Opal blinked slowly. "Ruby was your mother, wasn't she? And Joseph was your uncle." "That's right," she said. "Is it him?" I asked. "Is the skeleton Joseph?" Opal laced her fingers together and put her hands in her lap. I'm sorry, dear, she said, but I'm afraid my answer is the same one Joe must have given you yesterday. I can't say. My pulse throbbed in the achy knot at the back of my head. Let me guess, you promised your mom on her deathbed, I said. Opal laughed. Gracious, no, dear. Nothing so dramatic as that. But Mother asked me not to discuss the matter, so I don't. I stood up quickly, nearly knocking over my chair. The old familiar pinch at the top of my nose was back, and I didn't want to cry in front of a woman I barely knew. Thank you for your time. I turned fast enough toward the door that it must have come across as rude. Mom's Mercedes keys were already in my hand. Rowan! I stopped. Yes, ma'am? Do you always give up so easy? I just thought... I know you did. But hasn't anyone ever told you it takes old women like me a while to warm up our engines? I'm sorry, I stammered. She shook her head and sighed. Don't apologize, young lady. Just help me to the parlor. And listen. There it is, Opal said. My grandmother's Model 14. But what you're really after is the smaller machine sitting on top. She pointed to a Victrola cabinet that was as tall as Uncle Chacha's, but not quite as fancy. The thing on top of it was a strange-looking box with a hose and a small horn attached to it. What is that? I asked. A dictaphone. She let go of my arm, took a cigar box down from the bookshelf beside her, and handed me a key from inside it. Here you go, she said. The dictaphone cylinders are in that locked cupboard over there. I unlocked the door. The shelves inside were filled with rows of antique cardboard cylinders marked Edison Gold Molded Records Echo All Over the World. Each was numbered in black, starting at 1, ending at 40. My fingertips slid along their curved fronts as I asked Opal what was on them. Answers, she said. To some of your questions, at least. Mother carried the rest of them to her grave. But I never did have children of my own, and it would be nice to pass on what I do know before I'm gone. Besides, Tilda said you're the girl Arvin was trying to help when that evil man killed him. I expect the confession on those cylinders won't be your first clue that the world can be a hard place. I took out the cylinder marked number 1. You're sure you want to know? She asked. I'm sure, I said. Opal smiled sadly. Then you'd best settle in and make yourself comfortable, young lady. It's going to be a long afternoon.
William. Maple Ridge was still as a grave. No children playing, no gardeners snipping hedges, no workmen hammering. But Cleet's father's Cadillac was there, parked in front of a 3-story mansion just north of Mama and Pop's new place. The sight of it froze up every gear inside me and near stopped my heart. Vernon had found Ruby and Joseph. I got out of the Model T, cursing myself for leaving my Springfield in the truck the night before, and slipped along the northern wall of our new house. Church bells tolled 10 times in the distance. I peeked around the corner, saw that the door to the servants' quarters was open. Caught the wretched stink of a Maduro Robusto mingling with the smoke from Greenwood. Then a gunshot shattered the air into a million jagged pieces, each one sharpened on the high, thin scream that followed. I catapulted across the yard, lurching to a stop in front of the door. Vernon Fish stood not 5 feet inside, Maybelle at the end of one arm, Ruby's neck hooked in the crook of the other. Joseph slumped against the wall at the far end of the room, blood seeping from a hole in his left shoulder. And Vernon must not have heard me, for he rubbed his cheek slow across Ruby, saying, "That's just for starters, boy. I don't aim to let Maybelle have her way with you until I've had mine with your sister." Joseph said nothing,
only heaved forward onto his belly and commenced to drag himself across the floor towards Vernon. Vernon pressed the gun to Ruby's temple. Joseph stopped. I raised my hand, hoping Joseph would notice the motion and see me standing there. And though his eyes never shifted and his expression never changed, I knew from the way he held his blink half a second too long that he'd seen me. Vernon lowered Maybelle and ran the back of his hand down Ruby's blouse. My heart sped up. I bent my knees, dropping down until my fingers wrapped around a brick sitting atop the pile next to the door. I took a careful step forward, making ready to pounce. That's when my foot hit the twig. Vernon swung around quick as a cat, Ruby hanging from his arm like a broken rag doll. His eyes burned behind the curl of smoke from his cigar, and at the sight of me, he laughed out loud. Well, shit twice and fall back in, he spit. Old half-breed decided to show up after all. I drew myself tall as I could and stepped inside. Vernon pushed Maybelle's barrel against Ruby's head, said, Now, you just put down that brick and don't go getting any wild ideas, boy, or I'll shoot all three of you dead. I set the brick on the ground, forced myself to smile, saying, There's no need for that, Mr. Fish. Come to apologize. Which I reckon wasn't what he'd expected to hear. What do you mean? He growled. I mean, I've been to Greenwood and seen what's transpired. I talked to Pop, too, and he explained how he finally saw the light and joined the clan, and why I need to be a man and do the same. I understand now, Mr. Fish. White folks have let things get out of control and need to set them right again. I may only be half white, but I aim to be a part of that, sir. I truly do. How? He asked wearily. I took a step forward. Vernon's arm tightened, lifting Ruby's toes off the ground. I'll show you, I said, raising both my empty hands, if you'll just allow me to get something from that boy's pocket. Vernon shifted sideways, watching close as he let me pass. I went to Joseph and pulled out his wallet. His eyes were downcast. Here, I said, showing Vernon the Victrola receipt. This is what I came for. I stood up slow, putting the paper and the wallet on the floor in front of him. Then I stepped back, and he dropped Ruby and told her to pick them up. Do it, he shouted, but she didn't respond. And she did. Hold it so I can read it, Vernon barked. Ruby grasped the receipt on either side and raised it high, and then I saw it. A quick little blink my way that told me she was with me. Vernon scanned the paper, said, What are all these figures about? Pop sold this boy a Victrola in a moment of weakness, I told him. A while later, he came back while Pop was out, claiming he forgot his receipt. I believed him, and made one up for him myself. At the time, I thought I was doing right. Only last night, I realized what a fool I'd been. Why, all this boy has to do is show that paper around. Then Pop's name could get dragged through the mud, and our business right along with it. Couldn't let it stand, Mr. Fish. That's why I brought the boy and his sister here. So I could get the receipt back and make sure neither of them ever got a chance to ruin my pop. Vernon's cheek twitched. Just how did you plan on doing that? He asked. I told him I'd aimed to sweet-talk Joseph into giving me the receipt, and once that was done, I'd meant to get my shotgun from the Model T parked out on the street and finish things for good. There's plenty of places to hide bodies around a construction site, I said. Places no one would ever look. Vernon's mouth pulled up in a nasty leer, and he folded the receipt into his wallet and put it in his back pocket, then turned and slapped Ruby so hard that she half stumbled, half flew across the room and onto the floor. Her hand went to her mouth. Come here, boy, he said, which I did. And he yanked me closer and laughed as Ruby spit out the tooth he'd knocked free. You first, he whispered into my ear. I stammered that I didn't know what he meant. Hell if you don't, he said. Told him maybe I did, but I wasn't sure how to go about it. He rolled his eyes and pulled at the buttons on his trousers with one hand while the other kept Maybelle trained on Ruby. A feral look came into his eyes as his gaze locked onto her like a wolf's does its prey. He He went closer and towed her with his boot. I looked quick over my shoulder. Saw blood streaked across the boards from where Joseph had quietly dragged himself. Then I felt a tug at my